This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. John McGarren with Hermione Lee, recorded in Santa Fe, April 7, 2004. Irish novelist and short fiction writer John McGarren is considered to be one of his country's greatest living writers. In this program, he reads selections from three of his novels, The Pornographer, Amongst Women, and By the Lake, and from a short story called Gold Watch, before joining in a lively conversation with English literary critic and biographer Hermione Lee.
Detail on the lives of a small rural community in the corner of Ireland that he knows so well has been a huge success here in the States, as it has been in Europe. And it's added to his already immensely distinguished reputation, as well as being a recipient of the Lannan Literary Award this year. John McGarren has a veritable cornucopia of literary prizes and honours, including the title from France of the Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts et de Lettres, the American Irish Award, the Irish Times Aer Lingus Prize, the AE Memorial Award, and the GBA Book Prize awarded by John Updike. Without slipping into the kind of exaggeration or blarney that his own characters are so wary of, I do believe that John McGarren is a great writer to be spoken of alongside his countrymen Joyce and Beckett or Frank O'Connor or Patrick Kavanagh. He's not a prolific or a fast writer. In the 1960s and 70s, he published four startling, daring, bleak and remarkable novels of Irish life, The Barracks, The Dark, The Leave-Taking, and The Pornographer. They dealt with what he's called the moral climate in which he grew up, terror of damnation, the confusion and guilt and plain ignorance that surrounded sex, I'm quoting him, the power of the church, violence and abuses within family life, and the Catholic education system. These were shocking books in their time, and The Dark was banned in Ireland. It was 25 years after that that his magnificent, powerful, moving novel of Irish family life amongst women was published in 1990 to huge acclaim both within and outside Ireland. From the 1970s onwards, John McGarren was also writing plays for radio, for the television, and for the stage, and his marvellous short stories, many of which were brought together in the 1992 volume of collected stories, which includes some long, almost novella-like stories, such as The Country Funeral. By the Lake was published in 2002. That's 12 years after Amongst Women. John McGarren is not a writer who lets go of things. He works his fiction over and over, slowly and painstakingly, sometimes returning to his books, for instance, to The Leave-Taking, and revising them. And he returns, too, to his places and landscapes, his characters and subjects, like Monet painting and repainting his water lilies, or Chekhov dwelling over on his scenes of Russian life in his stories. For instance, the tyrannical father, Michael Moran, in Amongst Women, and his long-suffering second wife, Rose, recur in several of the stories. The landscape of lake and farm, of meadows and hill, of church and graveyard in By the Lake has long haunted him. John Rutledge, the character who I think is most like his author in this novel, notices when he's helping to build the roof of a new shed that when the rafters frame the sky, the whole sky grows out from that small space. So do McGarren's novels and stories seem to reach out beyond the local frame that he returns to and that shapes them. Though he's so concerned with return and memory and with the relation between the past and the present, I don't want to make him out to be glum or static, and you will see in a moment that he's very far from glum. The novels are full of shocks and surprises. Sometimes they are violent and cruel, but sometimes they're funny and absurd. The smallest things in everyday life create excitement. It's all going to be very interesting, says one character at the beginning of Spring in By the Lake. But the pictures he paints also have a marvelous quality of grace and stillness. There's a phrase he uses in this novel where he talks about a deeply affecting serenity. And I think he has that quality in his own writing. He once said that good writing should have an inner formality or calm. And I think it's this that makes John McGarren's writing so rare. He's going to come and read to you, and then there's a kind of little rearrangement of the stage before we have our conversation, and then there'll be a book signing afterwards. So please welcome John McGahan.
I begin with a very small scene from The Pornographer, where in the novel everything is done in terms of something else. And this was a ritual in Ireland called Sunday visiting. The telephone has more or less done away with it, but I think that anything real never goes away, it just takes other forms. Cars pull up outside. Apologies and cautious smiles ease themselves out of front seats. A child slams a back door. Having first discerned who has landed from the cover of the back of the living room, smiles of surprise and delight are wreathed into shape on the doorstep of the porch. Little runs and thrills and pats and chortles go to answer one another till all hesitant, discordant notes are lost in the sweet medley of hypocrisy. Tea is made. The visit ends as it began. Relief breaking through the trills of thanks and promises and small playful scolds. And now, be sure and don't let it be as long until you come again. We'll think bad of you. Now it's your turn to visit us the next time. You've been just promising for far too long. And then each family settles down to a solid hour of criticism of the other. The boring visit ended. It is the way we define and reassert ourselves, rejecting those foreign bodies as we sharpen and restore our sense of self. Now, I read a very short passage from Amongst Women. I received many letters from women about this novel, but I received one in particular from a woman in County Sligo, and she said that her father was like Moran, the father in Amongst Women, except he was far worse, and that there are three daughters in the novel, but they had seven, and she said that the father wanted to get all the girls married locally, and his way of getting them married, she had a marvellous phrase, which it was not unlike Jane Austen's, where she said that he first found a piece of land that had an unattached man attached to it. And then she said, if you saw what was brought in that was attached to the land, you wouldn't wonder that the whole seven of us are in England. So, the young boy has run away, and the girls come home to mourn, they expect that he'll be very angry with them, but he's very surprising, and when he actually behaves nicely, they're inordinately grateful, as often happens with difficult people. And when I was writing this, I often leaned on this passage to get rid of the worst passages. I'm thankful for all you did for Michael, he surprised them by saying, as they waited in the car outside the railway station the next evening. Well, we're sorry we couldn't get him to come home, Mona said. I know you did your best. That's all anybody in the family can do. On the platform, he kissed them as the train drew in. They told them they would be down again before very long. The two sisters were silent as the train crossed the Shannon, travelling through fields. As the train was pulling into Drummond, the small platform Blackwood people like themselves returning to Dublin at the end of the weekend, Mona said in an emotional voice, "No matter what they say, Daddy can be wonderful." Sheila nodded her head in vigorous agreement. "When Daddy's nice, he's just great. He's like no other person." And even the small white stones under the lights on the station platform took on a special glow. Morn went out to the road and closed the iron gates under the yew after returning with the car from the station. He listened for the noise of the diesel train crossing the plains behind the house, but it had already passed. The light was beginning to fail, but he did not want to go into the house. In a methodical way, he set out to walk his land, field by blind field. He had not grown up on these fields, but they felt to him as if he had. He had bought them with the money he'd been given on leaving the army. The small pension wasn't enough to live on, but with working the fields, he had turned it into a living. He'd be his own man here, he had thought, and for the first time in his life, he'd be away from people. Now he went from field to field, no longer kept as well as they once were, the hedges ragged, stones fallen from the walls, but he hardly needed the fields anymore. It did not take much to keep Rose and himself. It was like grasping water to think how quickly the years had passed here. They were nearly gone. It was in the nature of things, and yet it brought a sense of betrayal and anger, of never having understood anything much. Instead of using the fields, he sometimes felt as if the fields had used him. Soon they would be using someone else in his place. It was unlikely to be either of his sons. He tried to imagine someone running the place after he was gone and could not. He continued walking the fields like a man trying to see. I read a story, the end of a story, from Gold Watch. Ireland is a very old country, but it's also a very young country. And people from my generation, the difference between their lives and their father's lives because of education was often very great. And that created tensions. And in this story is that the father gives the son a gold watch because he feels it won't get it working anymore. And communications isn't very good. The son has got married without telling the father, and the father has sold the farm without telling the son. And so the son comes home, as he does every year, and he's a lawyer, married to a lawyer, and he's brought the father a new watch that he bought at Montreal Airport to replace the old gold watch. And this is what happened. All the meadows had been cut and saved, the bales stacked in groups of five or six and roofed with green grass. The big meadow beyond the beaches was completely clean, the bales having been taken in. Though I had come intending to make it my last summer at the hay, I now felt a keen outrage that it had been ended without me. "What happened?" I asked when I found my father at last. "The winter feeding got too much for us," my father said. "We decided to sell the meadows." "Why didn't you tell me?" My father and Rose exchanged looks, but my father spoke as if he was delivering a prepared statement. "We didn't like to, and anyhow we thought you'd want to come, hay or no hay. Anyhow, I've bought these. I handed Rose the box of chocolates and a bottle of scent and gave my father the watch. What's this for? He asked. It's the watch I told you I'd get in place of the old watch. I don't need a watch, he said. I got it anyhow. What do you think of it? It's ugly, he said, turning it over. It was expensive enough, I named the price, and that was duty-free. They must have seen you coming then. No, it's guaranteed for 5 years. It's dustproof, shockproof, waterproof. The old gold watch, do you still have that? He changed after a silence. Of course. Did you ever get it working? No, I lied, but it's sort of nice to have. That doesn't make much sense to me. Well, you'll find that the new watch is working well anyway. What use have I for time anymore, he said. But I saw him start to wind and examine the new watch, and he was wearing it at breakfast the next morning. He seemed to want it to be seen as he buttered toast and reached across for milk and sugar. What did you want to get so up so early for, he said to me. You should have lain in and taken a good rest when you had the chance. What will you be doing today, I asked. Not much. A bit of fooling around. I might get spray ready for the potatoes. It'd be an ideal day for hay, I said, looking out the window on the fields. The morning was as blue and cool as the plums still touched with dew down by the hay shed. There was a spider webbing over the grass. I took a book and headed towards the shelter of the beeches in the big meadow, for when the sun would eventually beat through, the day would be uncomfortably hot. Halfway down each page, I find I'd lost every thread and was staring blankly at the words. I found myself stirring uncomfortably in my suit, missing my old loose clothes, the smell of diesel in the meadow, the blades of grass shivering as they fell, the long teeth of the raker kicking the hay into rows, all the jangle and bustle and busyness of the meadows. I heard the clear blows of hammer on stone. My father was sledging stones that had fallen from the archway where once the workman's bell had hung. Some of the stones had been part of the arch and were quite beautiful. There seemed no point in breaking them up. I moved closer, taking care to stay hidden in the shade of the beeches. As the sledge rose, the watch glittered on my father's wrist. I followed it down, saw the shudder that ran through his arms as the metal met the stone. A watch was always removed from the wrist before such violent work. I waited. In this heat, he could not keep up such work for long. He brought the sledge down again and again, the watch glittering, the shock shuddering through his arms. When he stopped, before he wiped the sweat away, he put the watch to his ear and listened intently. What I'd guessed was certain now. From the irritable way he threw the sledge aside, it was clear that the watch was still running. That afternoon, I helped him fill the tar barrel with water for spraying the potatoes, though he made it clear he didn't want help. When he put the bag of bluestone into the barrel to steep, he thrust the watch deep into the water before my eyes. I'm going back to Dublin tomorrow, I said. I thought you were coming for 2 weeks. You always stayed 2 weeks before. There's no need for me here now. It's your holiday. You're as well off here as by the sea. It's as much of a change and far cheaper. I meant to tell you before and should have, but didn't. I am married now. Tell me more news, he said with an attempt at cool surprise, but I saw by his eyes that he already knew. We heard, but we didn't like to believe it. It's a bit late in the day for formal engagements, never mind invitations. I suppose we weren't important enough to be invited. There was no one at the wedding but ourselves. We invited no one, neither her people nor mine. Well, I suppose it was cheaper that way, he agreed. When will you spray? I'll spray tomorrow, he said, and we left the blue stone to steep in the barrel of water. With relief, I noticed he was no longer wearing the watch. But the feeling of unease was so great in the house that after dinner I went outside. It was a perfect moonlit night, the empty fields and beech trees and walls in clear yellow outline. The night seemed so full of serenity that it brought the very ache of longing for all of life to reflect its moonlit calm. But I knew too well it neither was nor could be. It was a dream of death. I went idly towards the orchard, and as I passed the tar barrel, I saw a thin fishing line hanging from a part of the low yew branch down into the barrel. I heard the ticking even before the wristwatch came up tied to the end of the line. What shocked me was that I felt neither surprise nor shock. I felt the bag that we'd left to steep earlier in the water. The blue stone had all melted down. It was a barrel of pure poison, ready for spraying. I listened to the ticking of the watch at the end of the line in silence before letting it drop back into the barrel. The poison had already eaten into the casing of the watch. The shining rim and back were no longer smooth. It could hardly run much past morning. The night was so still that the shadows of the beeches did not waver on the moonlit grass, seemed fixed like a leaf in rock. On the white marble, the gold watch must now be lying face upwards in this same light, silent or running. The ticking of the watch down in the barrel was so completely muffled by the spray that only by imagination could it be heard. A bird moved in some high branch, but afterwards the silence was so deep it began to hurt, and the longing grew for the bird or anything to stir again. I stood in that moonlit silence as if waiting for some word or truth, but none came, nor never came, and I grew amused at that part of myself that still expected something, standing like a fool out there in all that moonlit silence, when only what was increased or diminished as it changed, became only what is, becoming again what was, even faster than the small second hand, endlessly circling in the poison. Suddenly, the lights in the house went out. Before going into the house this last night to my room, I drew the watch up again out of the barrel by the line and listened to it tick, now purely amused by the expectation it renewed, that if I continued to listen to the ticking, some word or truth might come. And when I finally lowered the watch back down into the poison, I did it so carefully that no ripple or splash disturbed the quiet, and time, hardly surprisingly, was still running, time that did not have to run to any conclusion. Thank you. I read from the recent novel by the lake that they may face the rising sun in Ireland. I'll just read the opening. There's nothing to explain in an opening. A man walks into a room and a novel begins. Hello! 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 He called out softly in some exasperation. Jamesy, they turned to the voice with great friendliness. As he often stole silently into the room, they showed no surprise. you are welcome. Ye are no good. I have been standing here for several minutes and haven't heard a bad word said about anybody yet. Not a bad word, he repeated with mocking slowness as he came forward. We never speak badly about people. It's too dangerous. It can get you into trouble. Then ye never speak, or if you do, the pair of yous are not worth listening to. Kid, he held out an enormous hand. She pretended to be afraid to trust her hand to such strength. It was a game he played regularly. For him, all forms of social intercourse were merely different kinds of play. God hates a coward, Kate, he demanded, and she took his hand. Not until she cried, easy there, Jamesy, did he release his gently tightening grip with a low crow of triumph. You are one of God's troopers, Kate. Mr. Rutledge, he bowed solemnly. Mr. Murphy. No misters here, he protested. No misters in this part of the world. Nothing but broken down gentlemen. There are no misters in this house either. He that is down can fear no fall. Why don't you go to mass then, if you're that low? What's that got to do with it? You'd be like everybody else round here by now if you went to mass. I'd like to attend mass. I miss going. What's keeping you then? I don't believe. I don't believe, he mimicked. None of us believes and we go. That's no bar. I'd feel a hypocrite. Why do you go if you don't believe? To look at the girls. To see the whole performance, he cried out and started to shake with laughter. We go to see all the other hypocrites. Kate, what do you think about all this? You've hardly said a word. My parents were atheists, Kate said. The thought that all that exists is what you see. All that you are is what you think and appear to be. Give them no heed, Kate, he counseled gently. You are what you are, and to hell with the begrudgers. The way we perceive ourselves and how we are perceived are often very different, Rutledge said. Pay no heed to him either. He's just trying to twist and turn. When thought was married, he pissed in the bed and thought he was sweating. His wife thought otherwise. You'll get on as good as any of them, Kate. He took pruning shears from his pocket and placed them on the table. Thanks, he said, they were a comfort, pure Sheffield, great steel. I bought them from a stall in the Inniskillen market one Thursday. They weren't expensive. The North, he raised his hand for emphasis. The North of Ireland is a great place for bargains. Would you like a whiskey, Jamesy, she asked. Now you're talking, Kate, but you should know by now that will ya is a very bad word. Why bad? Look at your man, he pointed to where Rutledge had already taken glasses and a bottle of Powers from the cupboard and was running water into a brown jug. I'm slow, Kate said. You're not one bit slow, Kate. You just weren't brought up here. You nearly have to be born into a place to know what's going on and what to do. He wasn't brought up here. Oh, not too far off, near enough to know. He wasn't at school, but he met the scholars. Good health and more again tomorrow, he raised his glass. The crowd lying below in Shohan aren't drinking any drinks today. Good luck. What's the news? No news. Came looking for news, he cried ritually, and then could contain his news no longer. It is a ritual that takes everything again in the novel is repeated in terms of something else, and there's a ritual where Jamesy and Rutledge watch the All-Ireland finals on television. It's a bit like the Super Bowl here. And in September and October were lovely months. The summer ended, winter not yet in. The little veg pods on the banks turned black. Along the shore, a blue bloom came on the sloes. The blackberries mulled it and went unpicked. The briar leaves changed into browns and reds and yellows in the low hedges, against which the pheasant could walk unnoticed. Plums and apples and pears were picked and stored or given around. Honey was taken from the hives. The bees fed melted sugar. For a few brilliant days, the rowan berries were a shining red orange in the light from the water. And then each tree became a noisy infestation of small birds as it trembled with greedy, clamoring life until it was stripped clean. When the All-Ireland finals in Croke Park were live on television, Rutledge walked round the lake to watch the match with Jamesy. Jamesy poured whiskey and Mary made tea and sandwiches. The irregular striking of the clocks from every quarter of the house throughout the match served as a cool corrective to the excited commentary. The team Jamesy supported nearly always won. His support completely based on which of the teams he thought most likely to win and provide a triumphant, satisfying ending to the year. Once they lost, it was as if his judgment had been impugned. No use, he thrust out his hands. They should have been ashamed to turn out. It wasn't even worth looking at. When the match ended and was talked over for a while, Rutledge and Jamesy, accompanied by the two dogs, walked out to the lake. Thanks for the game. It was great fun, Rutledge said. The right team won this year anyway, he remarked complacently. We'll watch it again next year. With the help of God, Jamesy said firmly as they separated. The shore was dry, the fallen leaves rustling against his tread. Not until he reached the alder at the gate did he see the Mercedes stationed in front of the porch. Once he entered the house, he could hear his uncle chatting happily with Kate. Will he be able for it, Kate? That's the six marker. They were discussing the sale and transfer of the business. As he listened to the two voices he was so attached to and thought back to the afternoon, the striking of the clocks, the easy, pleasant company, the walk around the shore, with a rush of feeling, he felt that this must be happiness. As soon as the thought came to him, he fought it back, blaming the whiskey. The very idea was as dangerous as presumptive speech. Happiness could not be sought or worried into being or even fully grasped. It should be allowed its own slow pace that it passes unnoticed, if it ever comes at all. Thank you. Now, there's one villain in this novel who's already got married twice and has had many women, and the third wife, which he got out of the Knock Marriage Bureau, where the virgin appeared to the children, had the great good sense to run away after a week. Now, as Jamesy missed out on the news of the wedding, he's often referred to as the local TV radio station, he's determined not to miss on the breakup. And this is what happened. Already the new wife had come to realize that she had made a big mistake, but was keeping her own counsel. On the last evening, the family gave a dinner at the Central with toasts and all kinds of wishes for long lives and much happiness to the new couple, and afterwards there were drinks and a sing-song in the bar till late. They all said goodbye to one another that night in the central, with promises to see one another when they came again the following summer, if not before that, when, as they hoped, the happy couple would visit them in London. The next day, while the convoy of cars were crossing England, the wife packed all her personal belongings while John Quinn was away and walked to Strahan. A tall, fair-haired young man came by the car to the village an hour earlier. He had single pint of stout in the bar. Though he was polite and answered readily enough to the small talk of the bar, he didn't volunteer either where he was from or what business had brought him to Strahan. As soon as John Quinn's wife walked in the door, he rose and put his glass back on the counter and went and took the two suitcases she was carrying. They left without a word. There were only a few bars, few in the bar at the time. Nobody thought to get the registration number of the car, but they guessed by his appearance and by the way he went towards her that he was one of her sons. Jamesy had great belief in two spoons he used for casting from the shore, but fishing wasn't much on his mind this day. He was waiting to attract John Quinn's attention. And he would begin moving away from the house. He knew he'd only to wait. The old sheepdog came first. While continuing to cast and reel in the copper spoon, Jamesy was able to observe John Quinn's approach. He was still dressed in his wedding suit. "John Quinn is one happy and contented man this bright morning," Jamesy sang out as he drew close while reeling in and lifting the copper spoon from the water. "It's lovely to see good neighbors, innocent and at peace, and looking for something good for the table," John Quinn said. "You must be one happy man to be safely married again to a fine woman." Jamesy was all smiles as he turned the attention around. "I do my best to be happy and not live alone as the Lord intended. 'Tis not good for man to live alone, he himself has said. But I don't mind admitting that we have had a little setback that I'm hoping and praying will only be very temporary." "A setback?" Jamesy inquired. "A setback for John Quinn?" "Yes, Jamesy, you could call it a setback, but I'm hoping it'll be only temporary, no more than a hitch or a small hiccup. It's down in Holy Writ that what God has joined together, no man can put asunder. I was away on some business yesterday evening, and when I came back, I found she had left for her own part of the country. All she left behind was a note, and it wasn't a love note. Were there no signs or warnings?"
No signs worth remarking. We had a most wonderful week, the children taking us everywhere, and all happy and getting on wonderfully well together. Except one night, when we were most content and peaceable after the usual love performance, she turned to me and said, "John, I think I have made a big mistake." Women get strange notions like that from time to time, like children, and have to be humored. I told her what you have to tell them on such occasions, and when I heard nothing more, thought it was the sweet end of the figuery, and we were back to happiness again. "Still, you must have had a great week in spite of everything," John Quinn said. Jamesy had known him over a lifetime. John Quinn had circled and wheedled and bullied many in search of advantage. Now he was being circled expertly. "The children have done well for themselves and got on well in the world and wanted to do as good for their old father. They came in a great show of strength. Nothing was too much for them or too good. They brought us everywhere. Then we had the nights to ourselves. I don't mind telling you, Jamesy, it was like being young again. It was youth come back, and it wasn't wasted. We had the strength but not the know-how when we were young. She was a fine woman, Jamesy said. As fine as was ever handled, Jamesy, hadn't to be taught a single thing and was more solid and wholesome than a young woman. You could tell she had an easy, comfortable life and never got much hardship. She was as ripe as a good plum picked when it was about to fall off the tree. It was most beautiful. It was like going in and out of a most happy future. You're a terror, John Quinn. A pure, living, holy terror. Jamesy cheered, and John Quinn luxuriated in the rapt attention. Then this little slip-up came along and sort of went and spoiled everything. But please God, it'll be soon rectified, and everything will be back happy, and everybody getting on wonderfully well together again. I don't doubt it. I can't see John Quinn letting anything go without an almighty struggle. I don't doubt it for a minute. Even now, I'm negotiating for a happy outcome. Once you marry, you know, you have rights as well as duties. It can't be put away like a pair of old boots. It's my belief, anyhow, that she won't be got back to this part of the country. My plan is very plain and simple, and I'll tell you man to man, Jamesy, if the mountain won't go to Muhammad, then it was always said Muhammad had to go to the mountain. Jamesy went straight from John Quinn to the Rutledges. There were no games of stealth, of ghosting into the house to listen. The trolling rod was left in the fuchsia bushes at the gate, and he whooped and called out as he came in the short avenue and rapped with his palm on the glass of the porch. He could have been a small crowd returning victorious from a football match or a spectacular cattle sale. Kate was alone in the house and went to meet him in the porch. Rutledge heard the commotion and came in from the fields. Finding it much easier now, thanking you very much for your most kind inquiry, he called out mockingly as he threw himself down in the armchair and then could contain his news no longer. Gone, he laughed out. Gone, out the gap, gone. Who's gone? What's gone? A drink in the name of God before I die. John Quinn's wife has gone. Skipped it before the children were right back in England. Gone and left him stranded as long as he ran. Hit it for our own part of the country. Over whiskey and water, he went over the story at his ease, occasionally choking as he drank into his speech, but more often banging his glass down to hoot with laughter. I heard going to the Boggy Hollow described as many things in my time, but never as going in and out of a most happy future. Lord blesses, John Quinn is a living sight. He could think or do anything. He said it was like being young again, and she tasted like a ripe plum picked from the tree. I'd give good money to know what the plum thought. You're a disgrace, Jamesy. You are leading him on, Kate said. In answer, he cheered. Did she give no sign or warning, Rutledge asked. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But those like John Quinn are too bound up with themselves to heed. When they had done the love performance one night and were most happy and peaceful, she turned to him in the bed and said, I think I may have made a big mistake. That's the end, Kate said. Imagine having to go to a place like Knock to find someone like John Quinn. Lots go and won't be stopped, Jamesy laughed. Nature starts jabbing them. This tangle is far from over. Mark my words, John Quinn won't be got rid of so easily. They walked him to the gate.
where he retrieved the rod and copper spoon from the fuchsias, and then down to the water and part of the way round the shore. The sloes were already ripening on the blackthorn. Patches of yellow were appearing in the thick wall of green along the shore. There was rust on the briar leaves. Certain grasses and early vegetables were dying back. The lake was an enormous mirror turned to the depth of the sky, holding its lights and its colors. Close to the reeds there were many flies, and small shoals of perch were rippling the surface with hints of the teeming energy and life of the depths. The reeds had lost their green brightness and were leaning towards the water. Everything that had flowered had now come to fruit. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
I feel I've been not only sitting by the lake, but watching a whole stage full of people. I can hardly believe it was just the one man. One of the pieces you read was about happiness. And John Rutledge says that happiness is something that should pass unnoticed. Why does he say that? Why do you think, or why do you have him say in the novel, that you think happiness that is something you shouldn't look at or you shouldn't quite put your eye on?
Well, I think there are just a couple of things there. That they say that happiness writes white. Mm. The French writer Montalon said that. And I suppose happiness is also its own completion, but it's the most interesting thing in life. And when I set out to write by the lake, my ambition was to write about ordinary life, the kind of life that ordinarily writes white. And of course, the problem is how do you dramatize in earth material?
So happiness is in friendship or in nature or in just the everyday things of cutting a loaf of bread or having a conversation.
Looking out the window, watching somebody combing their hair. They often unregarded things.
Yes. And happiness is also, isn't it, as we saw so wonderfully in the reading, happiness is news, having news and being able to give it out. Why is news so important for these people?
I think news is important for everybody. We'd be lost if we didn't have other people. And in fact, I think that the only true journey to the self, the only true knowledge of the self, is through others and the knowledge of the world. Otherwise, one is looking at the pool of Narcissus.
So the news that you really want is not about yourself.
Not about ourselves. Yeah. I had a great friend in Leitrim who was longer there, and when we used to go together to the markets and things like that, he used to often look out the window in amazement, and he said, "John," he says, "you see nothing at home."
It's also, one of the things that happens in...
Well, I actually would think that you see everything at home.
Yes, quite. But one of the things that happens at home, and one of the things that happens very much in By the Lake, and also in some of the stories, is that people don't tell each other things that are new. They also tell each other things that they already know. Yes. There's a kind of almost ritual retelling of stories. Why does that happen? Why is that so important in these worlds that you describe?
I don't know. In the world that I grew up in, news was considered something like money. And it was to be doled out sparingly. And I remember meeting a very dear friend of mine
in town one day, and he was supposed to come to our house for dinner that evening. And we had, it was a surprise to meet him in the town, and ordinarily I wouldn't have any drinks, but we had 2 pints of stout. And since I was expecting, we had a chat, and since I was expecting to see him again that evening, I said, I won't say goodbye to you, because I'll see you again this evening. And he said, you won't. And I said, why, is there something wrong? And he said, no, he says, but you'll have no more news this evening. So I'd spent all my own news and wasted the evening.
Yes. But on the other hand, there is a way people will come into the room and they'll say, let's hear that again, or, you know, we want to hear it again. It's a good thing to hear things again. There's something almost reassuring or consolatory to have those stories going round again. Isn't that the case?
It is, but I also think that repetition is one of the most important things in life. I mean, each day repeats itself and yet doesn't repeat itself. Everything happens the same, but always slightly differently. And I think that that repetition is very close to happiness, and it's the dear, precious life.
Mm. And that repetition and happiness also has to do with staying in the same place to an extent, with, as you say, with being at home. I mean, these novels and stories, these are very, very local. They are very much rooted in a highly specific place, and the place keeps coming back. You know, you recognize the graveyard on the hill, or the evergreens that were cut down around the church. There's a landscape that you build up through your work. But you yourself have not always lived in the same place. You've kind of gone away and come back. I mean, do you want to be thought of as a local writer, and does it offend you if someone describes you as that?
Oh, no, I actually would consider it to be a great honour to be described as a local writer, because I think that local is the universal, but with the walls removed.
Do you want to say a bit more?
Well, is that all news, going back to the original question, all news is local news, and that's universal. But then when the hatreds and strife and prejudices that are local are removed, you get to the thought and feeling that is in everywhere. You get the same feeling, say, in John Donne, where he says, the lovers, let us make one room in everywhere. And I would consider that a great local line.
Mm. But doesn't that mean then that in your writing you're looking to a kind of Ireland that in a way is past or passing, where the people can live in a small world, in a kind of small contained world? Isn't it the case that what you're doing partly is a kind of elegiac description of something that's going even as we look at it in your books? Or is that not true?
I think that that's true and it's untrue. I think that everything is passing, and there's actually nothing more out of date than the most highly fashionable.
It's almost
gone out of existence before it comes into existence.
Yeah.
And I love a sentence, because it's very Euclidean, that the great French writer Proust says, where he says, fashion, which is begotten from the desire for change, is quick to change itself.
Hmm.
That's a deadly sentence.
It is. But are you not reproached ever for this? Are you not reproached for writing about an Ireland that is no longer in existence?
Yeah, but I don't think that the present-day Ireland is in existence either.
That's a hostage to fortune.
No. You should tell that to the government, though.
Yeah. But it's true that you're keeping stuff out, you know, that you've chosen to write about a particular kind of landscape and particular types. I mean, there's a story called Old Fashioned where the boy grows up and he comes back to make a film about the darkest side of Irish life. And he says all the people who interested him were dead, you know, that it's kind of past.
Yeah, well, Ireland is a very strange country. It's a very, very old country in one sense, and it's a very new I referred to that in Gold Watch, you know, where, in fact, it's almost, I mean, the country has only came into being in 1921. And I was the first generation, you know, that got freely education. And in that sense of Gold Watch, I mean, people in my class, one of them became an ambassador to America, and they became the meritocracy that ran the country, that is running the country. But then it came out of a very old culture. For instance, we, in the village I grew up in, we had a very bad football team. And we always played out of defense. And whenever a high-relieving clearance went on the wind out of defense in Charlie's Field, is a big, great roar from the sidelines used to go up, and it's the word was Salamanca. And it was only later that I discovered that in the 17th and 18th century, during the penal laws, boys went from our part of the country to study for the priesthood by foot and horseback and fishing boat, to study for the priesthood in Salamanca. And I've always thought of Salamanca as about the outer reaches of the North's common imagination. And it has always interested me that sometimes words like people have to go underground and live for a couple of centuries in disguise.
And then come back.
And I said that the word Salamanca, having lived for most of a century as a mighty ball booted on the wind out of defense in Charlie's Field, grew sails again on an open sea, became a walled city with spires in the sun.
Wonderful. I almost hesitate to say this because this has been such a ravishingly funny thing to listen to tonight. But there is a tremendous amount of darkness and savagery in your work. These are not kind books very often. There's a kind of violence and darkness which partly has to do with the politics of Ireland and the history of Ireland, which partly has to do with these terrible family lives that you describe. Is this darkness in you, or is this an Irish darkness?
Well, somebody said about me recently in Ireland that I had everything wrong. That when I should have been enjoying myself, I was full of violence and darkness. And now when I should be saying my prayers, I'm beginning to enjoy myself.
That's a very indirect response.
Well, it wasn't meant to be, but it's a discomforting question, because it actually leads you into very deep waters, and I'm not sure if they're not too deep for fathoming, Ireland was a very hidden country, and it was completely, in my childhood, dominated by the Catholic Church. And heaven and hell and purgatory in my childhood was as much closer than Australia or America. I think that the Catholic Church, I'm very grateful in many ways to my upbringing in the Church, because it taught me a great deal about ceremony and mystery and sacrament and the equality of all men and women under the sun. But I think it did an enormous amount of harm in sexual matters. And it was a very puritanical church. It was a Romanesque church, a kind of fortress church. And I think that what should be a holy sacrament between people, sexuality, they turned into something dark and sinful. When I was young, it was sort of witty, but it was meant to be funny, but it was kind of true as well. I said it was in Ireland, it was a lesser sin to kill somebody than to kiss them. And I think that's completely wrong myself.
But these characters, there are characters in your books, particularly Moran, and Moran comes in other guises too, who are almost possessed with a kind of rage against the world and against their own lives. There's this terrible sense of futility that possesses some of your characters, perhaps particularly in the earlier works. There's a real anger that goes through. And is that to do with this kind of repression and system of repression, or is it something else?
Well, I think it's very complicated, and that's why maybe I try to avoid it in the first place, is that the people say, like my father and uncles would have fought in the War of Independence and the Civil War. And they actually dreamed of a new democratic Ireland. And they saw that a kind of fairly disgusting middle class allied to the church took over the country, who had no imagination, whose function was to keep people down. And it can never be forgotten that in the 1950s and 60s, when I was in my 20s, that over 600,000 people emigrated from the country, when only 3 million in the people, some of 600,000 people emigrated to England and to America. And some of those felt betrayed by their own country, and rightly betrayed, and were full of anger. And I worked as a student on building sites in London. I heard that kind of anger expressed marvelously by a young building worker. Sometimes in that local census, these people in England read their own local newspapers, like the Connacht Champion or the Roscommon Herald or the Leitrim Observer. That was their local news, and they passed these newspapers around. And one of them was reading out that there was another wet summer in Ireland. Which is no surprise, anybody that knows the country. And that prayers were being offered in all the churches for the rains to cease. And this young fellow listening to this pair of news said, may it never stop, he says. May it rise higher than it did for fucking Noah. May they all have to climb trees. And I think that attitude of that country was widespread. Of course, I mean, the country is a far better place now. People have more sexual freedom, they have more money, and instead of people having to immigrate, actually there are all sorts of people, black people, yellow people, white people, coming into Ireland, which causes a new kind of problem.
I see I'm not going to get a serious answer out of you. But that actually does usefully take me on to something else I want to ask you about, which is speech. We've heard so many voices tonight, and the life is always coming into these different voices, and people speak to each other all the way through your novels and stories. But quite often, there are things that they can't or won't say to each other. There's a wonderful episode in By the Lake where the son who's gone away and is working on the Ford production line in London is thinking he's going to have to come back and live with his parents. And although they love and cherish him, they cannot abide the thought that he might actually have to come and live with them forever. But they can't find a way of saying no. Is this a characteristic of people that you know in this world?
Yes, round where the people that I grew up in, I mean, they're marvelous people. And they came out of a long tradition of interdependence, and they were very gentle, but there were people that would never give you a direct answer. I describe it, it was a language that had no easy way of saying no. It can be very frustrating for outsiders, because, for instance, of course, the Gaelic speech comes into it as well, because nobody in Ireland will ask you, are you going to town? They'll say, you wouldn't be any chance be going to town now, would you?
Yes. Yes. But is the does the Gaelic, the Gaelic which you speak, yes, does the Gaelic run under your own prose, do you think? Do you think that the kind of rhythm which is your style, which is your voice that lies under these other voices, do you think there is a kind of ghost of Gaelic in
yes.
that?
Yes, yeah. And I think that there's an extraordinary thing happening because English is such, a world language now, is that there are many languages in English with almost their own separate literatures. I mean, was a writer at Myra Alistair MacLeod was here recently, and he and Alice Munro and Mavis Gallant are almost creating a new Canadian voice.
Absolutely.
And the same in Ireland and the same in India, and there's a literature in Australia and New Zealand, and I suppose in America is the dominant literature now. It's all different.
But go back to your own voice. I mean, is your own voice, do you think, a particular kind of inflected English that couldn't be the way it is without the Gaelic running underneath it?
Well, Beckett, a lot of the things that is taught existential in Beckett is just local speech. I mean, for instance, that sentence is completely rampant in my part of the country. Are you there? And the answer is, am I? And of course, the next question is, are you all there?
There's a phrase that was used in the title of the English and the Irish edition of By the Lake. You mentioned it in passing when you were reading, which is the phrase, that they may face the rising sun. And that's a very important phrase in the novel. And I want you to explain it. But I also note that it coexists with a number of people in the book, particularly Kate, actually, saying, this world is all there is. This life is what we have. This world is it. There isn't anything else. And yet this phrase, that they may face the rising sun, perhaps suggests something else. Could you explain the phrase?
Well, the phrase is that in the Christian tradition is that people are always buried in Ireland if they know what they're doing, which isn't always true, no more than anywhere else. And that they're buried so that when they rise up in the mythical last day, they will face the rising sun. So they're buried with their heads in the west. And there's a very interesting dialogue at the end of By the Lake where there's a frustrated academic saying that we got it all wrong, that they had to make the top of the grave wider. And actually, in the 19th century, the priests tried to get the people to bury their dead facing the church, the church being the symbol of truth. Mm. But they always thought that the sun was a better bet than the church.
So it's a kind of pagan, there's a sort of pagan undertow, a sort of almost mythic pagan feeling in the book that underlies this Christianity you've been talking about.
That's right. And a friend of mine, the man that wouldn't come to the house because I had spent all my news in the town, said that once he was referring to the priest, he says, which is a kind of historical imagination, though he'd be surprised to hear that it was. He says, there was a time we had the owl druids on our back, and now we have this crowd.
But this idea that the old druids might have given you some sense that there was some hope of resurrection, that you might wake up and face the rising sun, I mean, does that coexist in your imagination with the sense that this world is all there is? I mean, do you have some slight
Actually, that's kind of teased out at the end of By the Lake, where Jamesy and Rutledge is talking, they've buried Jamesy's brother, and Rutledge refers to Jamesy refers in the sense of that local,
He says, I haven't traveled far, but I've known the whole world. And Rutledge says, and you were my sweet guide. Mm-hmm. And then Jamesy asks, do you think, is there an afterlife? And Rutledge answers that, I don't think there is, but I don't know. And surely it's not unreasonable to think that you will go back into whatever meaning we came from. But Jamesy isn't too convinced about this. He says, still, he says, you wouldn't want to leave yourself too caught out in case you was, in case you did find there was something there when you crossed over. Yes. So you should hedge your bets on that.
Exactly. So there's a kind of hedging of bets going on. Yeah. Yeah. Do you think your work has become more tender and appeased and less bleak and grim?
I would hope so. But I always like the thing that Chekhov said, that when a writer takes a pen into his or her hand, they accuse themselves of unanswerable egotism. And all they can do with decency after that is to bow. And I believe that there's too much emphasis placed on the artist. And it comes out of a sense of romanticism. And I think that that each of us inhabits a private world which other people cannot see. And it's that world that we read out of. And the only difference between the writer and the reader is that the writer has the talent or the misfortune to need to dramatize that world. But a book, I think Joyce described the piano as a coffin of music. And I think a book is just a coffin of words. And it doesn't live again until it finds readers. And it will emerge in as many different versions as the readers it's honored enough to find.
But what you're partly saying is that you are... Yeah. But it's partly that you are saying that you keep yourself hidden as the artist. In the fiction, that you don't write the kind of fiction, and we could all name the sort of people who do, that is all about yourself. And yet, is it not the case that you are now writing your autobiography?
That's true.
And so how does that feel? What is the difference between writing fiction, where many things that happen in your novels are to do with your own life and people that you know? What is the difference between doing that and now writing the real thing as it happened to you?
Well, I love a thing that Flaubert said, is that the writer should be present everywhere, like God in nature, but nowhere visible. Mm. And I don't think it's very much different. It is profoundly different, like the new day is the same day, but it's a completely different day. And I deal with that in the memoir, I suppose more a memoir than an autobiography, is that somehow I've always made my writing mistakes when I've dealt too closely with life, with the life that I knew. And somehow, there's a phrase of Yeats where he says, let difficulty be our plow. Mm-hmm. And I think that for some reason is that for the tension in fiction to live, that the material has to be reinvented or reimagined or dislocated in some way that is almost the same as being reinvented in order to be true. And it's very complicated, but it's very simple. I mean, one of the reasons is that fiction has to be always believable, while life has never to be believable. And a great deal of it isn't. So this time,
a lot of the stuff that I'm writing hasn't to be believable. And that I'm actually drawing directly from my life. And also, you also know how untrustworthy memory is. And the writing I have finished and I'm revising now would be very bad writing if it sailed out under the guise of fiction, which is profoundly different.
So are you making yourself up, really?
I'd say I'm making myself down.
Well, I think that's a good moment at which to say my thanks to the unbelievable John McGahan for a truly wonderful and extraordinarily playful, complicated, and also, I think, candid interview. I very much like that phrase of James's, which I quoted in my introduction, where he comes in and says, it's going to be spring and everything's going to be very interesting. And when I came here tonight, I knew that everything was going to be very interesting. Thank you very much.
Can I say a few? I want to thank everybody as well, but I want to say before I leave that I admire all Hermione Lee's work. But I think that her book on Virginia Woolf is one of the great biographies of our time.
Oh, thank you. It's my reward.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Ed Wiege-Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.